Access number 28678, Commander Dermot Road, Reel 16. Now, what happened next then? I mean, you've got these visitors, you know, largely based in Britain. What happens next?
Well, we just, we were coming towards the end of our trials now, and it came time for the captain to leave, sadly, and be replaced. But he was replaced by then Captain Jeremy Black, later Admiral Sir Jeremy Black, who was also a Second Sea Lord, whom I had known before because he was a gunnery specialist, and another very good captain, excellent captain.
Is good? What do you think of him? Why was he good? I mean, everyone's different, but...
Yeah, they're different. He was, in some ways, they were similar. They were both, there was no ranting and I never heard either of them raise a voice in anger and shout. I mean, they got what they wanted, but by force of personality and sort of calm actions and demeanour. Jeremy Black was a similar sort of guy, again, found it very easy to talk to sailors. A very experienced sea commander officer. He was not as athletic, not so much as a sort of sportsman as Michael Livesey, but very similar in having a great sense of humour, easy to talk to, very approachable. And I can't say much more about him. He was another superb character.
Now, was it a happy ship? It sounds like it was.
But tremendously, you know, happy.
What makes a happy ship? You might say the executive officer, but I mean, what does...
No, no, you might say despite the executive officer, it was a happy ship. What makes a happy ship is having a bunch of people, or sailors there, who come aboard a ship and they know what they have to do, they know what's expected of them. They're treated firmly but fairly. They know where they are. They know how far they can go without getting into trouble. They know what the end game is, what they're striving for. You engender a team spirit in them. It's like a big family in many respects, and all the better if they play any form of sport or games or any activity that means that they'll operate together. They cement these sort of relationships and the bonding thing in two ways. First of all, ashore, when often they go ashore with their friends or in small groups. And if there's any problem, they always look after their own people. Those who might have trouble getting back to the ship after a good run ashore would be helped by those who are perhaps not quite so well gone. But also, they bond through adversity. They go through training. They go through tough times. They go through emergencies on board. And the expression, you know, we're all in the same boat, is absolutely true for them. And so they built up this great team spirit, esprit de corps. And if they're properly treated and properly led and guided from the top by the management, then they will respond and have returned that respect and loyalty. And it's a question, above all else, loyalty.
Now, what's the next thing that happens then? You've got a new captain. You must be getting quite near the time for leaving, but...
I'm not far from it, yes. New captain, and so the ship is now getting ready for a deployment abroad, another... sort of small deployment, and I think we should go out to the Far East this time. However, that shortly after the captain, new captain arrived, I was selected for promotion to captain, which meant that I would be promoted captain in 6 months' time. I'd already done 2 years on board, and so I was past the time I needed to go. And so I, on promotion to captain, I went to see the naval assistant to the Second Sea Lord, who was due, the chap who promoted, or who appointed senior officers, captains. And he said to me, what do you want to do? And I said, oh, I wouldn't mind mind another command, and I wouldn't mind a job in training, perhaps tactical skills, something like that. Good, he said. You're going to Naples. How does that grab you? I looked at him. I'd only been to Naples once before, as a very young subaltern, and then I remember distinctly that you could smell Naples before you could see it, and it was a pretty grubby place. So I said, do I have to? And he said, yes, you bloody well do. Pack your bags and get out there. And I was appointed to the Commander-in-Chief Naval Forces Southern Europe, SICNAV South, who was an Italian admiral who had his headquarters in Naples.
Now, what was your rank then?
I was still the commander in Invincible. And this was going to be in April.
Now, what year are we in? 81?
82. I joined Invincible 79. Left her in 82.
So just before the Falklands?
We're coming up to that.
Right. I see. So, you were sent out. Now, what were you sent? This naval, this is to the admiral. What was his name? What were you?
There is a major NATO headquarters in Naples, SINCSAL, Commander-in-Chief, Southern Europe, who is an American admiral. Under him, he has some subordinate commanders, one of whom is SINCNAVSAL, or Commander-in-Chief, Naval Forces Southern Europe, who is an Italian four-star admiral.
Do you remember his name?
No.
And what were you going to be to him?
I was going to be his Deputy Assistant Chief of Staff Operations. DCOS Ops. My immediate boss was going to be a Greek admiral. And his name was Alexandropoulos. His boss was a British vice admiral who was chief of staff to the Italian admiral. And
it's a rather complicated command structure.
Oh, it is. I tell you, yes. Well, if I can start saying, well, perhaps it might be easier until we wait till I get there.
Okay.
Yeah. In the meantime, I was still Invincible. I've been to see the appointer, and this was about February 1982, and I was due to leave in April, first week in April, and so my relief was appointed to join on the, I think it was the 5th of April. And I would then depart for Naples, my new job. However, I think the 5th of April happened to be my birthday. It was a Monday, though. But that Friday, the previous Friday, or was it just before, the Falklands blew up. And I worked the whole, in fact, three days. We worked the whole weekend storing ship for war. That meant getting all the war stores, extra war stores on board, all the ammunition topped up to war states. I mean, everybody worked 24 hours about, everybody. We had to start tearing up the wardroom carpets, getting rid of the trophies, all non-essential gear was taken ashore. In the meantime, my relief was due to arrive. And I thought, what do I do? And the captain said to me, we had a chat, and he said, well, no, it's up to you. He said, I'd be more than happy to keep you. He said, but, it's 8,000 miles to the Falklands, and it's early days. It may be a wasted journey. So I sat at home thinking, for all one night, thinking, do I stay with this ship? all that after 3 years and been promoted. I was ready in some ways to go. Or do I assume that Mrs. Thatcher will sort all this out and we'll get halfway, 4,000 miles halfway to Falklands, and they'll sort it out. We'll have to turn around and come back home again. And I remember fleetingly in my Cod War days when I joined the ship at a great hurry, got them all worked up and fired up to go to Cod War, and the government got it sorted out before we even got there. And so I almost tossed a coin, but I decided then to go on to Naples, be promoted, go on to Naples, and let my relief come in. I knew that there would be time on passage for him to, and he was with a very good team, to work himself up and in. And so on the Monday morning, I left the ship and I went straight to the Sallyport in Portsmouth and watched her sail for the Falklands, along with a lot of other people. And, of course, history then tells you what happened. So I spent the worst 5 weeks of my life after that, knowing no more than the average Joe, watching television news and hearing snippets of what the force and ships have been up to.
You regretted it?
Oh, of course I do, yeah. In retrospect.
Now, you were going to be... let's move... I mean, we might as well move on. Because
so when I went in Naples...
That's Deputy Assistant Chief of Staff Operations at Naval Forces Southern Europe...
Headquarters.
Right, yes.
Yes, that was in the island of Nisida, which is just outside Naples.
You weren't actually in Naples?
Well, it was in Naples, but it was just off... It wasn't in the main NATO headquarters. We were about a couple of miles away, just off the coast, in a little harbour. Actually, ideal spot for sailors.
That's called Nisida?
Nisida, N-I-S-I-D-A. And now, the setup there was the commander-in-chief was an Italian admiral who also had a national hat, so he wasn't always there. The show was really run by a British vice-admiral. He had, as chief of staff, he had under him five deputy chiefs of staff who were all admiral or admiral equivalents from various NATO nations. An American, a Greek, a Turk, another Brit, and must have been somebody else I can't quite think of. Or perhaps that was it. Oh, another Italian rear admiral. Another Italian rear admiral. And they all had deputy chiefs of staff of captain's rank, who their bosses were in many ways political animals. They kept their eye on the political animals. And there were a lot of sort of eddies and currents and subversive sort of movements in the NATO world still. And of course, having the Greeks and the Turks working together on the same staff in the same building was was not always a happy relationship. Having said that, I got on extremely well with both. I have a lot of time for the Turks and a lot of time for the Greeks. My own boss was a most charming man, he was always on the phone first thing in the morning to Athens to find out the latest in the sort of political situation there. And I virtually ran that department, the operations department. And the operations side was the biggest of the divisions, and we ran all the exercises, and we had a 24-hour fully manned operations room where all the maritime movements were passed, of warships were passed in, and we kept an eye on the maritime plot there. And we also, Mary, we had an emergency war headquarters in the middle of a mountain just to the north of Naples, and we used to go there every year for a couple of weeks to do an exercise, and we ran that.
In the emergency war headquarters? I mean, was it just a duplicate of the operations room only in...
Oh, no, it was much bigger. The emergency war headquarters could take the whole of the NATO command. I mean, this was the big cheese from the commander-in-chief Southern Europe, from the main NATO headquarters in Naples. And so it was full of mainly Americans, but soldiers, sailors and airmen. enormous set. I mean, we're talking about well, a couple of thousand people probably, all in the middle of this mountain.
Now, what about the exercises you were running? What type of exercises?
We ran varying exercises. We ran a standing annual mind sweeping exercise, a mind clearing exercise.
Tell me about that.
It was run by my one of my staff officers, who was an Italian commander, who was a mine warfare expert, and we used to get NATO, one ship from each of the local NATO people, four, five or six, certainly one British, to search for dummy mines which had been laid, and it was really a practical mine clearing or mine sweeping exercise, a mine finding. And that lasted a couple of weeks, and it was normally based, well, it varied, but it could be based in Sicily, where I remember one time, and then off Genoa, and smaller places around the country. We also had every year a standing NATO squadron in the Mediterranean, one frigate from each of the nations. We used to take it in turn to command that, well, the ship. Ships used to take it in turn to be senior officers. We used to organise their programmes for them and their exercises. And I used to do a fair amount of travelling, visiting to see them. I went to Venice and to Athens and various other places. But my main job was running the department which contained the ops room, which was the focus of the department.
Did you enjoy this staff posting?
I loved it. I went to Naples reluctantly, A, because my ship was in the Falklands, and B, because I didn't have a very good opinion of Naples really beforehand. And I mean, the driving was appalling. Absolutely, it's the worst place in the world for driving. Almost as bad as Istanbul, I think. And I went out there, and I thought, well, I'm not going to last two weeks on the road, never mind 2 years. Within 2 weeks, I was just as bad a driver as the Avenue to Neapolitan. We were living out in flats. I found a flat, and I loved it. Loved every minute of the 2 years there. Like the Italians, and the impression I got was a sort of biased wartime impression one has of the Italian services. I found them willing, very good ships, good equipment, efficient. I like the people, I like the food, I like the wine. I guess if I was to say, I think Italy is the only other European country that I would live in apart from my own. So I became quite devoted for them. I made a mistake. Made a mistake on the first day of asking a senior member of my Italian staff if he was Neapolitan, and he spluttered and coughed for a minute and said, "Certainly not," he said. "Naples is a bloody place. It is not Italy." He came from Milan, and of course there's a tremendous amount of rivalry. The northern Italians always claim that they make the money to subsidise and support the southern Italians. Southern Italy voted en bloc for a kingdom at the referendum after the war. The northerners all voted for a republic. And to be taken for a Neapolitan was an insult that he found very difficult. I mean, he was a charming bloke, nice, and we laughed about it often afterwards. They were great. Heavily American orientated, the setup there. They had their own enclave, their own sort of patch. They had their own high school out there, own facilities, and they helped us with a lot of ours. We ran a British pub out there, which they were desperate to become members of, but not many of them, we just couldn't because of the numbers. And the British community out there, and there were wives and children out there, were fabulous.
So
a wonderful time.
Anything in particular happened? You know, events? Or was it just routine exercises and that kind of thing?
It was routine exercises and things like the church summer fete every summer to raise money for the Anglican Church in Naples. Just like being in this country with stalls and everything. And everybody came. The Americans thought it was fabulous. But nothing earth-shattering. No, there were no sort of operational scares. I mean,
was there any tension within the NATO over the Falklands? Because I mean,
no. My boss couldn't wait to get me there to find out my Greek. And his first question: "Were you at the Falklands? Were you at the Falklands? Tell me about it. I've heard this. I've heard that." They were all of them were very supportive and said, "Of course you went in and sort them out." There was never any question that we'd done the wrong thing.
Now, so what happens? You were there from April 82 till?
I was there from April 82 until 1984.
Now which month?
Summer 84. And, of course, about 6 months. Yeah, 5 or 6 months before I left Naples, I was told my next appointment, which was to command HMS Gloucester, which was another fabulous job.
Now, what was HMS Gloucester?
HMS Gloucester was then being built and was one of the new stretched Type 42 anti-aircraft guided missile destroyers.
So, what was she like? I mean,
incredible. She was the end batch of a class of Type 42 destroyers, which were armed with their primary armament was the Sea Dart surface-to-air missile, which had a surface-to-surface capability. They had a 4.5-inch gun for anti-aircraft and mainly naval gunfire support, and they had a helicopter, anti-submarine and anti-surface duties. However, they, in design, for some reason, I think one of cost or something, they've been actually cut short by about 20 feet, the original batch. And so the first six, I think, came out. It was four or six came out as these short Type 42s. But the last three, it was the York, the Gloucester, and the Manchester, I think, were reinstated. They had another 20 feet put on their bows, and so it made them very long bows, look very racy. And because the original design of the ship had been this long, they were actually faster for the same engines as the original ones. We could do 32 knots, and the short ones could only do 30. And so it was a sort of lean greyhound of the sea. It was fabulous. And here was this ship being built by Vosper Thornycrofts in Southampton, the biggest ship they had ever built. And it was so big that the shed they built it in, they had to take the end off so the bows could poke out. And so here I was, back in the somewhat familiar position of standing by a ship building. This time not with Vickers in Barrow, but with Vosper Thornycrofts in Southampton, on a smaller scale. But I was the captain this time, and I could live at home because I lived then in Portsmouth, and so I daily commuted to Southampton. But I had the same aim, is to get this initially a small dedicated bunch of technical, skilled, senior ratings and officers, gradually expanding until the ship went to sea and we took over we did the Invincible, on a smaller scale, of course. But it was very interesting there because I suppose to some extent it could be expected. In Invincible at Barrow with Vickers, everybody was fascinated by this ship, and of course certainly the senior management showed a very close interest. I did not find the same with Vosper Thornycrofts, and I called on the managing director when I arrived. That's the last time I ever saw him. He never came to see me, never visited the ship, and all we have normally, so despite the fact this is the biggest ship they'd ever built, a very great friend and ally was the ship manager.
So how does it go? What happens?
It went extremely well, but as we were due to go, we gave a farewell cocktail party. So I thought, right. So I didn't invite any of the board or directors. I invited the people who'd actually built the ship and the cleaners. And they were, it was amazing. Some elderly lady, she said, oh, Captain, she said, my husband's bought the first suit he's bought for 50 years, especially to come to this. Made you feel very, very humble. And I was glad I'd done that, actually, because they were the people who had actually produced the ship for us, and to an extremely high standard. It was beautifully finished. And, of course, went like a bird.
Now, what happened there? So,
we went off to sea to do the sea trials. Under the red ensign, and I sat there, you know, watching what was going on, having no responsibility, while all these civilians were playing around with my ship. Very much shorter than the big trials with the Invincible.
Well, this was a much more known commodity, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a smaller ship, and it was the fifth of the class. So, apart from the fact being longer, it was different in a way. It was certainly, as you say, a known commodity, so they weren't as long and arduous.
Any problems?
No, only some little niggling things. No, it all went extremely well, very smoothly. We came back to Portsmouth, and I signed for the ship, and the White Ensign was hoisted. And that's how I know. All you do, there was I signing for millions of pounds of the taxpayers' money. There's a little note saying, I accept HMS Gloucester into service, signed D.I. Rhodes.
Was there a commissioning ceremony?
Yes, we had a commissioning ceremony later on. Now, the Duchess of Gloucester had launched the ship, and so we invited her to commissioning. And she was lovely, absolutely lovely. And I went up to St. James Palace to call on her and talk about this. And I said to her that we'd, hope she didn't mind, but we thought, if she would like, we'd also invite the Duke. And she said, certainly not. She said, he's got his regiment. It's my ship. But I would like to bring my son, she said, who was the young Earl of Ulster. And she did. She came, and again it was a lovely day, and I'd invited the mayor of Gloucester, our affiliated town. We had quite a lot to do while we were waiting with the Gloucester. The mayor of Gloucester was a formidable elderly lady, a spinster, retired headmistress teacher, who was a pacifist and a teetotaler. I invited her to lunch and thought, what on earth are we going to talk about? But she was a tremendous character. And she was not so much interested in what the ship who the ship would be shooting at or firing at. She just wanted to make sure the sailors were going to be properly looked after. And we returned visit to Gloucester one specific occasion to the cathedral. But we were there over a couple of days. And the first night, there was some problem with some nightclub would not allow sailors in uniform, whatever. And she heard of this, and she threatened to have them closed. She said she would take away their license unless they let the sailors in, the mayor. But we went to Gloucester specifically. I unveiled a memorial window to the previous HMS Gloucester, which was a cruiser sunk during the Battle of Crete. Sunk by aircraft, and over 700 of the ship's company were lost all at once, and the 40 odd that survived were all taken prisoner by the Germans, and didn't of course get home until 4 years later at the end of the war. Now when they got home, they all dispersed, and of course never thought, and there was nothing in the city to commemorate the ship of theirs, which had been sunk with tremendous loss of life, over 700. They'd lost two captains within the space of 3 months. One had been killed on the bridge during an air attack, and then this one was actually killed also during an air attack at the Battle of Crete. His body was later recovered and only identified because of the signals he got in his pocket. There was a survivors' organisation, and we got in touch with those, and I said, look, I can't, I've been around Gloucester Cathedral, and there's no, nothing to suggest you ever existed. Anyway, we eventually got a stained glass window put up there, and we all went, the whole ship's company went to dedicate this. And it was very moving, if nothing else, then the sailors kept asking me, we've never heard of our captain again. We've never seen his family. We've got our wives, what have you. And it would be lovely just to see him, his family. And I was waiting just outside the cathedral with the ship's company and survivors lined up. And a lady came up to me. And she said, my father was the captain. The guy who was killed. And it was quite moving to see these old chaps meet their captain's daughter after such a long time. And so that was another memorable occasion, but for the old and Gloucester. But it was all part of the modern ship build-up. We went and did work up.
Now, what was the working up trial?
That was Portland again. Same old story. Little sleep, a lot of heartache, a lot of hard work.
So no different. A
lot of sea
really.
Time.
The same basic program.
Yeah, it's the same basic pattern for all the ships, actually.